Well. My name is Tyler Byrne, and you're listening to Lo-Fi Lit. On today's episode of this spectacular podcast, I interviewed Mike Young, the poet. Through talking to Mike, who's been here and done so many different projects, I could name them all off. I just feel like to Mike, maybe they're not as important. Maybe the thing right now is important. Mike is in a band called Clementine Was Right. They're on tour right now. I think it's wrapping up. We recorded this before it occurred, and I was supposed to maybe put this out. I would have liked to put this out beforehand, but that's just not how things turned out. I could name off the things that Mike has done. However, I feel like with Mike, it's not the projects and the books aren't as important as the people that, you know, this is going to sound cliche, but it's the people that Mike has met along the way. To Mike, remembering someone's name is so much more important than maybe remembering the thing that they did together. It's more about the moments and sharing moments with people up close and personal and having that energy. I think that's what Mike is all about and what Mike appreciates about this community and isn't looking for money or fame, but just hanging out, having a good time, sleeping on someone's couch. That seems to be Mike's sort of vibe. And I hope you guys enjoy the show. Thank you for listening. This is Lo-Fi Lit.
So I grew up in like rural Northern California, right? And I mean, you grew up in Tulsa? You live in Tulsa,
yeah,
right now?
Tulsa.
So it's sort of like similar where I grew up in California, right? Like my dad's side of the family is all from like Arkansas and Oklahoma, like Dust Bowl, right? So a lot of like, and we grew up like super poor and like we had like garbage bags for curtain, like when the curtain broke in my room, like it was like a garbage bag to replace the curtain, right? But we also like had a computer because my dad was very obsessed with computers and perhaps like would spend like what little money we had on this like hobby that he was obsessed with, and like instead of like having like a car or something. And so like, yes, this was the context of like like the sort of weird poor, which I feel like most poor people are in fact, like it's like a weirder version of being poor than like people who are not poor understand. But yeah, so we had a computer and this was like the mid 90s. I was like 10 in 1996. So some of the games that I really, and so we didn't have a lot of games, right? See above about being poor, but like Daggerfall, which was like the precursor to like Skyrim, was like a game I was really into. And like, I remember like the games I wanted to take apart were like RPGs, or like there was this Star Wars first person shooter that like somehow I found like a level editor like on the internet called Dark Forces. And it was like, and so then I started, and it had like a cool physics engine, but I don't know, it was sort of like anything. It was sort of like anything. I just wanted to like, wanted to change the names of all the baseball players, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Are you glad that your dad though bought a computer instead of say like a
oh phone? for sure. I mean, like I think that, I mean, it's, you know, you look back on your life and it's you just can't disentangle your trajectory, right? Like it all seems like retroactively like yes, that had to happen. And like, for example, like HTML Giant or whatever, like I grew up in this little town called Oroville, and it was pretty I didn't know any poets. I didn't know any writers. Like, I barely knew, like, you know, some of my friends, you know, like, you know, it was like punk music, and like there was like an auto shop dirt yard, you know, where we would have like hardcore shows or whatever, but like all those people I like met on the internet, like when I was like 19. And, and that was because my dad was really into computers. You know, it was Pell Grants and for to go to college. And it was the fact that my dad was into computers. So, I mean, I would literally not be like who I, you know what I mean? It's like none of it would have been happened the way it happened if I hadn't had like a fucking 486.
Have you talked to him about that?
My dad is passed away in 2021.
Okay. Sorry to hear
But it was sort of hard. I mean, my dad, I don't know, you know, like, so my dad was like a pretty interesting person and it was very difficult. He had some very specific beliefs about the world and about like who he was and about the nature of the universe and God and whatnot, that were, I was very into when I was a kid and sort of didn't know any better and then became very hard to reconcile as I got older. So it was like very hard to really sort of like sit back and chat with him when he was still alive, because there was so much that was sort of simmering. You know, I felt very resentful of having to grow up so weird.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite memory of him when you were young?
My favorite memory of my dad. Well, you know, I mean, I think people who are your parents alive?
Yeah, I live with them.
Cool. I'm glad. I think like if when you, I don't know, like I've talked to other people who like, you know, like it's just, you do soften, right?
You soften. You have to, you have to be patient with them. Yeah.
Once they die and there's this like hard stop, and there's something very liberating about, well, all these things that I was sort of like just waiting around, like crossing my arms, very like, well, why don't you get this fixed, you know, inside yourself? And then once that's no longer possible over the years, these last 4 years that he's been gone, it's, I've been like, well, I guess it just didn't work. I guess, you know, it's in amber now, it's frozen. And I think my favorite, and so my memories have softened for sure. And I think my favorite memory, he was a very funny guy. He was so funny. And like when he wanted to be, just so wacky and charismatic. And but yeah, so there, he had this Oregon Ducks hat and he was really into the Oregon Ducks. And he would always go like quack, quack, like when they did well. And yeah, just, he would make jokes and when he was very silly, I always, cause he was very severe, you know, like sort of like a Robin Williams kind of type, right? Like sometimes very severe and depressed and sometimes just very wacky, you know?
So with the computer and the building, the levels of a video game, why didn't you kind of go into that? How do you go into, start leading into poetry?
That's a good question. I sort of do like coding stuff for my day job, for some of my day job. But I think it's a really good question, because I think that it was like the desire was like animated by this sort of tinkery kind of mindset, right? Where you're just like, I want to take that apart. I want to figure out this composite parts. And I have this friend, Alec, who's a great musician here in Denver. And he's a great drummer and he wants to get into cooking, you know, because my partner, Gian, and I, we do a lot of cooking. And he's like, how do you guys, like, I want to learn about cooking. And I've been thinking about like how to describe it to him in a way that sort of relates back to music. And I was like thinking about like, well, salt, fat, acid, heat, right? Like that's like the 12 notes, right, of this. And I was just thinking about, so yeah, I've always been into this, like, how does this break down? Like what is the sort of underlying structure? And I think language is ultimately the most interesting system to me. Of all the systems that are out there, of all the ways that like people and nature organize things, language is ultimately like more interesting than code, more interesting than like math, to me. Like, language just feels so mysterious and so like freighted, and like it can conjure shit, and like, I don't know. I think just language is it for me, you know? Like, some people it's paint, and some people it's the 12 notes, right? Mm-hmm. Some people it's like code, you know, but I think language. And so, yeah, just that idea of like, just the coolest system, you know, is language. And that's what took me, I think, into poetry. Yeah.
You just said something that completely threw me. And it, I guess it goes back to the language thing. I thought Gion was like your musical, like, you guys were in a band?
We were in a band and in love.
Oh, okay, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's both.
Nice. So when in school do you go into, like, did you major in English, like in high school?
I did. Yeah. College? Yeah. No, I did major in English, and I went to, a community college for a year outside of Mount Shasta, College of the Siskiyous. And then I went to Southern Oregon University, in Ashland, Oregon, which is like a cool town that has Shakespeare plays, and now it has a lot of wine bars and fires, both of which are sad, but it also has Shakespeare plays, which are cool. And then I went to, UMass Amherst for MFA.
What was that?
It was great. So my era at UMass was 2007 to about 2010 and a little bit beyond, when I still lived in town with a break. I lived in Baltimore for a year and a half or so. But it was great. My friend Jack Christian, who is also a great poet, used to call it the masters of fucking around. It was definitely that. I mean, to set the scene, right? Like, in 2008, it was very millennial, right? No. We were in grad school for poetry during that recession. Mm-hmm. And we were at the bar in November 2008 when Obama got elected, and we were shocked. And the bartender was this dude, Chris, real Massachusetts dude. And everybody was silent, like watching Obama's speech on TV. And he was like, just running around being like, I've never seen this many people at the bar since the Red Sox won, you know?
Oh yeah, that was just years earlier, yeah.
Yeah, we all went out to this club called The Basement. That was Hugo's, that bar was Hugo's, RIP. And then we all went out to this club called The Basement, RIP, and like danced, and we were so optimistic, and there were no drone strikes yet. You know, we were all naive and enchanted, and now all those bars are gone, and Obama's, you know, just another war criminal.
Do you miss that period?
Oh, I mean, I think that like physiologically, it's hard not to, but like I miss being 22, you know, like, and I look forward to, I have these friends and I really cherish these friendships. Like, I have this friend, Irene Oliver Lewis, in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And she is just an amazing person. She's in her 70s. And she has just lived a life of art. And she's like the queen of Las Cruces. And she's just like, I am not at the point yet where I like don't miss being in my 20s, but she doesn't give a fuck. And she like is so, you know, she's wearing her like shawls and she's so triumphant, and she's, you know, like life, she's figured it out. I mean, I don't think she thinks of it this way. You know, there's still sadness and death and like bewilderment and whatever, but like, yes, I miss being in my 20s right now, being 38, but I look forward to the day where it all makes sense and I just sort of stroll around in some town and in the redwoods and just laugh at the youth, you know?
Do you try to capture that feeling in those moments in your music?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, the music, that's a good question too. I think that a lot of the Clementine Was Right music sort of ends up back at this feeling of, you know, because as you've been hearing, right, like I grew up in this very little town, very sort of like meth and like tribal casinos and like a giant dam in rural Northern California. And I lived all over the place, right? Lived all these different places. And, but in many ways, like where I learned how life works was like walking along the Feather River, you know, in Oroville, and thinking back at all the people I knew back then. And they all remain so mysterious to me. Like there was this guy who was the landlord who owned the building that we lived in for a while, but then like his life fell apart and he ended up like, I think the rumor was that he ended up like living in a cave, literally in a cave, like somewhere like in the Feather River Canyon. And like, I remember eating, he was like, there was, he ate like cat food in the cave. And like, I just like, not like, there's so many things about the world that I just don't make sense, you know, and you arrange them into images and then you try, and then you test these images against these like mantras almost, right? And then like, and those are like the choruses of the songs. And like, and so, yeah, I would say that the music does have a lot to do with the past and just the things that sort of float back up into the present and remain just like unknowable to me. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Did you write that down in a journal and then came up with it, or you just like come up with that like on the spot?
I just came up with it. I enjoy having the opportunity to sort of turn the faucet on, you know, because like most of life I'm like, you know, talking on Zoom and I'm like, well, the spreadsheet has, you know what I mean? And like, but the faucet's always going. It's just whether I'm allowed to sort of in the context of the moment, like turn it on. And I had a couple cups of coffee today, you know, I got ready for this. I tried to really like turn it on, you know, but yes, I mean, but also again, like, and I think people understand this, like Gian and I were having this conversation actually about this the other night before, as we were falling asleep, just what is it about certain images that like float back up into your consciousness, right? Like some of them you understand, right? Some of them you're like, oh, this person wronged me, or oh, that was disgusting, or like, but some of them are just so mysterious, you know? And I think a lot of not being an artist is like being afraid of those images when they float up and you're like, oh, get away, you know? Mm-hmm. Like give me some fucking like Super Bowl or whatever. But then I think being an artist is like being like, yeah, let me just chew on that. Let me just like spit it out, because I don't know what it means, but I'm not afraid of that, you know?
Is that the theory of like the auteur, of like the directors, that they always kind of use familiar themes throughout their...
Maybe. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. I love it when artists have things that they are sort of unabashedly obsessed with, and are like confidently just mystified by, you know, I mean, like David Lynch, right? Like that's sort of a obvious example. But I think I think about like the way, like in, oh God, what's her name? Claire Denis is another film director. Since you said auteur, I was thinking about film directors, and she always has these men dancing, and like the way that her camera takes on men is like very beautiful and mystified. And so, yeah, I think I really love it when artists are just like, I don't know why the fuck I'm obsessed with this, but I'm obsessed with it, you know?
You're talking about turning on the faucet. Do you think you can talk like that because you've written poetry for so long and you've read poetry for so long that it's like all in your head and you're able to like put it back out into the world?
I think it's the second of those, right? Because I've read so much, you know? And I also think, so yes, and I also think going back to my dad, so like my dad, one of the primary modes in which he lived was to just be talking with my mom all the time, right? So he had a lot of ideas and a lot of visions and a lot of like things that he was always sort of inventing in his head. And I remember like as a kid, I would wake up, and my dad smoked cigarettes, and he smoked cigarettes inside, and we lived on the third floor of like an apartment building. So I would I remember as a kid, like waking up to like the sound of his voice as he was talking to my mom, and just, he was very good at being extemporaneous and keeping the volleyball afloat. I know I said faucet, now it's a volleyball, so I apologize. But and then just seeing him sort of shrouded in smoke and Pall Mall unfiltered cigarettes is what he smoked, and just talking and just his face sort of peeking through the smoke. And so I think, yeah, reading plus that.
Mm-hmm. That's nice. So who were the first poets that you clicked with?
So that's a great question. So when I was like a teenager, I was really into song lyrics, right? So I got into poetry through song lyrics, and it was sort of the usual suspects, like Leonard Cohen, Jeff Mangum. I was really into this dude named David Gray, whose early songs are very good. He's mostly known for that Babylon song, which is kind of lame. Apologies to David Gray if he's listening to this podcast, but his early songs are cool, right? And then, okay, so then somehow, I think it was like Connor Oberst. Okay, I remember this. I was really into this band called The Tragically Hip, who were very poetic Canadian band, and like searching for them online, right? Remember computer isolated kid in rural Northern California. So I was searching for them online, and it was like these lily pads, right? So The Tragically Hip actually led me to Nick Drake, and then Nick Drake led me to Connor Oberst and Bright Eyes, and then that led me to Jeff Mangum and Neutral Milk Hotel. And somehow, I don't remember how this happened, but that led me to Frank Stanford. And the Arkansas poet Frank Stanford was one of the first like poets on the page who, because, you know, I read poetry in high school and I dug like T.S. Eliot, right? Like Measure Out My Life in Coffee Spoons, right? Like anything where it was like a line, you know, where it's like, yeah, that's a fucking line, right? And then Frank Stanford, I remember reading his poems online as a teenager, and, you know, he would have these like, you know, the book is full of my father's eyelashes. He treats the pages, that line kind of sucks, but the first part is good. The book is full of my father's eyelashes. And then I remember he ended a poem with, anyway, the rain came through like a hitchhiker. And I was like, hell yeah, brother, you know, like, and David Berman also, right? So it's the Silver Jews and David Berman, and so many great lines, you know, and the sea was always there to make you feel stupid, you know, when it snows, the outdoors feels like a room, all that stuff. I will say that, going back to the idea of going to UMass, you asked me what it's like going to UMass, and I know that you're a bit of a fan of the UMass poetry constellations, and we used to call it, or other people used to call it, like the UMass Mafia. But Peter Gizzi, who's a great poet and professor at UMass, he would, as a bit of, I mean, he's like a very smart dude, like a genius, right? And he has his like bibliography like in his head, and he can just spout whole poems. And that was like a real, it's like macho in like the cutest way, you know? And I was like, man, if I could just, I've only got a couple lines, right? And they drift in and out. But man, Peter Gizzi can just like rail out poems, and fucking great guy.
I want to say I'm so much as a fan as is like, I just know people that like have, I know people, and then like they end up going there or have gone there. And it's very strange. Like everyone kind of goes there.
Well, I mean, shout out to like Daryl Weyer, who I think, so far as I know, I mean, I don't purport to know the entire history of why UMass became UMass, but I think that Dara is at the heart of it in many ways, and Noy Holland and Sabrina Murray. And when I was there, Chris Batchelder, who's a terrific fiction writer, is there. But so far, and Jim, obviously, you know, James Tate. But I remember being there and like Dara and just the, you know, just like the way that she like modeled a life in poetry and a life in noticing language and a life in sort of being delighted by and also turning to language as a way of floating along for all this stuff, you know. And I remember this story she had in workshop one time about, like, she, like, is in my, as I recall, she, like, came into workshop and started telling this story apropos of nothing about how she was driving along and people kept, like, pointing and waving at her. And she was like, oh, wow, people are being so friendly today. And then she finally got to where she was going and she got out of the car, closed the door, and she saw on the roof of the car, she'd left a jar of sun tea. And the full jar of sun tea had been just like sliding around. So everybody waving at her was like worried that this jar of sun tea was going to like fall and crash. And I remember her telling that story and she laughed and she was like, isn't that kind of great? And that was one of her lines, right? Like, isn't that kind of great? That's kind of great. And that was like, and there is within that line embedded an ideology, right? And I think we all who were there at the time, like really soaked up and tried to understand that ideology and tried to sort of arm ourselves with that ideology against the decaying world to various degrees of success. But I love Darren and I loved my time at UMass. Yeah.
You're probably going to hate me for asking this question because it's probably come up a lot, but do you think if you hadn't gone, like the MFA thing, do you think if you hadn't gone, do you think you would have still known as much and had the same passion for poetry?
Probably had the same passion. Probably wouldn't have known. I mean, what do you mean known as much?
Like, you know, the MFA, not MFA thing. There's like people pro MFA, but there's people anti MFA. Do you think you could have learned as much as, like, you know, the workshops that you took, like through just reading books and writing in a journal to yourself?
Yes, absolutely. I wouldn't have known as many people. And I think that it is an economic premise to go to an MFA, at least when I was there. And, you know, like the world is fucking falling apart, right?
Yeah.
And like, and it's really fucking awful. And things are getting cut. But like I said, we were there during the 2008 recession and we were hiding out from the world. And we were getting, you know, paid to like sit around and talk about poetry and argue about, you know, whether Charles Olson was good or bad or whatever, right? And so I think it was a chance. And I was always, you know, like acutely aware as someone who grew up without any money of like the like privilege of the situation I was in. I felt like I was getting away with something. I felt like I was at like a party with a bunch of food on the table. And I was like, I have to eat all this food until I get sick because like, when else am I going to be in a room full of fucking food, you know? Mm. And so I think the MFA, and I don't know if it's like that these days, you know, because everything is changing so fast. And I don't think that the argument is interesting as an argument about art. I don't think it's interesting at all.
Yeah, I mean,
I think as an argument about how do we build a society where we can make like time to be creative available to everyone because everyone is creative, and how does quote unquote grad school and quote unquote MFAs, how does that all that shit fit in? That I think is like a very interesting, urgent, poignant question. But like, are you a better quote unquote writer or worse quote unquote writer if you go to an MFA? Like, it's just an incredibly fucking stupid question.
In my opinion,
I like to get fired up, you know.
If there was an MFA for like making a band, gone to that school?
Wow, what a question. What a question. That's a great question. That's a great question because, let me tell you why that's a great question. Because my path to music is sort of like a path back to music, right? So I was doing music and writing, sort of blending them together, right? Like imagine like a braid, right? Of two different color, like a fucking candy cane, right? Like until I was about in my early 20s, right? And then I went to, really it was when I went to the MFA and I had a band in the MFA, shout out to everybody in the Cinnamon Urns. You all know who you are. Dear friends in the Cinnamon Urns, Gabe and Gail and Christy and Ben and LK and I hope I don't, Jack was briefly in the Cinnamon Urns playing the frog. A little offbeat, but we loved him. And I sort of stopped doing music, right? And then I came back to music in my 30s when I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and started the band. And it was sort of bewildering to me because I came up in an era where the coolest thing was to be sort of bad at your instrument, you know, to be, that was like punk rock, was to be sort of bad at your instrument. And I didn't know people who like went to music school and like starting a band was like clandestine, right? Like it was like, you didn't go to music school. Like you went to music school if you were a nerd, right? But now, I mean, maybe that's not fucking true. I don't know. But now it's like all my friends who are in bands and who are like really fucking good musicians, a lot of them like went to music school. And it seems to have changed completely, like the ethos of it all. And yeah, maybe if I like was like born 10 years later, yeah, maybe I would have like, if there was an MFA, like for being, which I think there is, I just don't know about it, right? But yeah, there's like Berkeley, like the trumpet player in our band, Will, we love Will, William Cormac Mulligan is his name. He's a redheaded private investigator. And he went to Berkeley and he dropped out because he's too cool for Berkeley. But yeah, a lot of my dear pals here in Denver went to some great music programs here in Denver and stuff. So yeah, maybe, I don't know, just different era. You know, the world has changed so much.
So I realized you said something about you grew up like in a town called Orville. Didn't you have like one of your first chapbooks? It was like Orville.
Yeah, yeah, good research. Yeah, yeah, MC Orville's Answering Machine. That was published by Logan Ryan Smith, who's a cool dude. I think he's got some music he does these days, and he was out of the Bay Area, and it's called Transmission Press. And yeah, that was, so the premise of that chapbook was, I mean, I started writing those poems when I was like fucking 19 maybe. And so what was a 19-year-old doing feeling sort of guilty and weird about like leaving his hometown? I mean, the armchair psychoanalysis now that I'm 38 and I sort of have it a little more understood is that it was not actually that I was guilty about leaving my quote unquote shitty hometown. I was actually guilty about like extricating myself from what was sort of a mild and God bless it, sort of not very well run little cult that my dad was sort of cultivating, no pun intended, but that's what I was like guilty about extracting myself from, or extricating myself from. But, so the premise of MC Orville's Answer Machine was that MC Orville actually was a real dude, Jeff Shanker, cool poet who has a funny song called Meth Till Death. But I thought that the idea that there was an MC Orville, like the captain, the representative of Orville, right? Like MC fucking Orville. I thought that idea was so funny. And then I had this vision of like, what if your MC like leaves your town and then your town is bereft because its MC left? And what if everybody in town, maybe as a way to get the MC to come back or maybe just because they miss him, like leaves their life stories and, you know, on the MC Orville's answering machine? And even that is antiquated now, right? We don't have answering machines. We have voicemail, whatever. But yeah, so that's the premise of the chapbook, where all these prose poems about leaving your town on, the town leaving itself on its departed MC's answer machine. And actually like MC Orville was like Googling himself one night and like found it and emailed me and he was like, this is fucking weird, dude, but I dig it. You know, if you ever want to fucking like, I remember he said, chop it up sometime. And I never did. And I feel like I should have, you know, I was sort of too afraid and kind of a fucking moron because I was 20 and I was like, I don't know how to chop it up. And I will say, the last thing I will say about M.C. Orville's Answering Machine was, like, I finished that chapbook, like, I think maybe, like, my first year of grad school, or, like, maybe even before, maybe when I was still in college, still in undergrad. But I remember bringing one of the M.C. Orville poems into workshop, into one of Darrow's workshops, and it received a very lukewarm response because it had, like, poor people shit in it, you know? It had, like, Kraft dinner. And so I made this mental note, that, okay, I should not write about poor people shit. I should write, like, funny poems, about, like, my feelings, you know? And I don't think I was totally correct about that. I think maybe that just wasn't a great poem. I think it was a little half and half, you know, a little bit of both. But I have since then, I've spent the next 17 years of my life, like, trying to marry the idea of, like, I'm just basically trying to assert the fact that poor people can be funny about their feelings too, or something, you know?
Yeah. Do you really think it was because of the Kraft thing, the Kraft dinner that they...
I have no idea, dude. Okay. Yeah. I think that it was so different. Like, by that point in workshop, I brought in these funny poems and people were like, oh, he's a funny guy, you know, he's gonna write some funny poems and they'd be cute and sweet and, like, you know. And then I brought in this poem that was like, I don't even remember what was in it, but it was dark and it was, like, you know, full of despair, and I think maybe people thought that it was too much, or, like, I don't know, it doesn't matter. I mean, my interpretation of what was going on, I guess maybe I should go back and ask everybody, because I've never talked to them about it. You know, I, like, silently decided what everybody was thinking. but I remember one person in a different workshop, like, I remember going outside after the workshop and her poem had been workshopped, and she was crying because she thought everybody was really mean to her. And I was so bewildered and I felt so bad because, you know, I thought that everybody liked her poem, but something about the way we were talking about it, you know, made her cry. And that was very sad. And then that taught me to, like, maybe be nicer, and also taught me that, like, we just never have any idea what other people are thinking, you know? Mm-hmm.
So did you know about chapbooks at that time before you made your first one? Like, how did you find out about chapbooks?
And... That's a good question. How did I find out about... I don't remember. I mean, like, I found out about, like, online literary stuff. Honestly, like, through message boards. Hmm. And I think the Frank Stanford thing was a gateway drug. Shout out to another great poet, Matt Henriksen, who is no longer with us. It's very sad. And he was a real champion of Frank Stanford. But there was, like, these message boards. And then the message boards led me to discovering online magazines, and then just lurking in this world and sort of soaking up the stew, you know, of these languages. And then somebody would say chapbook and I would go fucking Google it. You know, I'd go fucking Google it when somebody said a word I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think the thing that frightens me the most, there's plenty of people out there still Googling, but sometimes I'll see someone commenting and, like, I don't know if we're actually all, like, stupider since COVID has arisen. I sometimes feel afraid that that's true, but I don't know. But sometimes I feel like I see this energy online that it just frightens me sometimes, because it's so different than the energy that I came up with online, where you were, like, just Googling stuff and it was cool to, like, know stuff. And I don't know. Yeah.
Maybe it's more immediate now.
Yeah. Or people are just, like, so reactive, and they don't look stuff up if they don't know it. And I just don't understand not wanting to look stuff up. I love looking stuff up. That's one of the reasons Gian and I love each other, is because we both love looking shit up. Mm-hmm. And Gian will be like, did you hear about you know, that there's an elephant who has like a mohawk, and mm-hmm. I'll be like, holy shit, no, I did not, you know.
That sounds like a podcast.
Maybe, I don't know. It's us hanging out in the van on tour, you know. That's mm-hmm. that's what it is. And I'm very excited about our tour coming up.
Oh yeah. You want to talk about that?
I swear that this is happening naturally. It sounds like I'm like marketing pilled, but I am genuinely excited about this tour in April with the band. I don't know when this episode will come out, but yeah, we are going on tour in April in the Southeast. And I think everybody in the band right now, we got Angus Smith on guitar and Will on trumpet and Sumner Earhart on drums and Evan Jeffers on bass. And we're going on tour with our dear pal Jude Brothers, who is an amazing harpist and singer-songwriter, and they're going to be playing some sets. But we're all just a bunch of gabbers, just a lot of gabbers on this tour. And so I'm just real excited to be in that van, getting a little cookout in North Carolina, getting a quesadilla with a side of quesadilla and just fucking gabbing. I'm very excited about that. Yeah.
Are you going to do any documentary style things?
Ooh, that's a great idea. I know Gion is always really good about just sort of organically being a sort of documentarian. And I think they are flirting. They do consistently flirt with the idea of taking a sort of more formal approach to it. And they've got this great idea cooking right now about doing a documentary around the Denver music scene. So he's got this idea where, because everybody sort of met each other after lockdown. And I think he's trying to figure out like how to make it sort of have, everybody thinks that their scene is the most special, you know, and he's trying to figure out like what the nugget is that is like, no, it really is the most special. But I'm very excited to see what he comes up with. Yeah.
Because I know like there's something that's like a trend is to take like a camcorder from like the early 2000s and like buy a used one off the internet and then start recording with that and using that as an aesthetic for like a document.
Yeah, maybe. Thing. That is like gives me such whiplash. We had this very cool younger pal named Xavier who was living with us in Denver for a while, who's friends with my friend Rashawn in Santa Fe, and he just wanted to come hang out in Denver. And he's a great musician and artist, both of them actually, Xavier and Rashawn. But Xavier was really into the camcorder thing, right? And he's like in his early 20s. But for me, like that was, this whole like lo-fi thing is always so weird to me to like wrap my head around, because again, if I had a shitty camera when I was a kid, it meant that I could not afford a nicer camera. So it feels in my head, this very like animal equation of like shitty quality bad, good quality good. Yeah. But I understand like intellectually, like no, shitty quality cool. You know, but I'm like, I have to like break my own sort of like thing around it, because it's not an instinctual relationship I have, to my detriment, like, because I agree aesthetically that like shitty quality cool, you know, but I have to like break my own like insecurity or whatever around it. So I don't know, maybe we don't have one of those, but you're right, they are cheap. Maybe we'll put it on a little digicam. Yeah.
So you were talking about back in the day being on like message boards and things with the, you know, internet literature community. Is that how you met Kujini and with Big Lux?
With Orchid. Yeah. So we actually met Orchid and I. So I love Orchid, and Orchid is one of my best friends.
Oh, nice.
I was at Orchid and Lane's wedding, and Orchid and I met at AWP actually in 2010. So we actually met in real life. I don't know. They came to a panel, Orchid and her partner at the time, Laura, came to a panel that John Wang of Juked.com put together with me and maybe Blake, and then maybe Reb Livingston of Note. I was on such a roll, but you know, I am fucking 38 and I can't remember everybody. But yeah, there was a panel and about just online literary magazines, and you know, and this was 2010. It was in Denver, actually, ironically, and I live in Denver now. But Orchid, like, we were very punk rock about it, you know, on our panel, and we were like, yeah, fucking online alternative literature. I guess I am sort of implicating us all in alt lit if I say alt. We didn't call it alt lit. We called it indie lit because we were fucking millennials. Yeah. Yeah, and I think like Orchid came up and was like, that's cool. I'm starting a magazine, Big Lux. And this was like very inspiring. I love Orchid, a terrific poet, a really wonderful person. And yeah, that's how we met. But a lot of the other folks, like I met Blake just through message boards. There was this thing called zoetrope.com.
Yep.
There was an online writing. Yeah. You know, you've done your homework. Met a bunch of people through there. I think Blake was on there. Matt Bell. Who else? Mary Miller was on there. Elizabeth Ellen was on Zoetrope, I think. Bunch of people, and I feel bad. Dave Clapper, who started Smoke Long Quarterly, which in my head was like the magazine. Like that was the magazine when I was like 18. I was like, I gotta fucking get published in Smoke Long fucking Quarterly. And then I did, and I was like, that's so cool. And then through Smoke Long, actually, I met Joe Young, who's a great fiction writer in Baltimore, not related to me, but we joke about being related. And then Adam Robinson, who's one of my best friends in the world and is just wonderful. He and Amy live in upstate New York now, and they're making their own little fucking biodome, beautiful utopia up there. With their beautiful children and bookstore, and yeah.
Can I ask, since you know Orchid so well, who's your favorite like Japanese wrestler?
I don't know as much about Japanese wrestling or about wrestling as Orchid. Orchid knows more about wrestling than I do. My one like cool feather in the hat wrestling thing. Do you know it? Did you do your homework on this?
Mae Young.
Yeah, you did. You did your homework. Yeah, so Mae Young was my aunt. My dad used to tell these stories because she was a little older than him, and he would do like pull-ups on her biceps when he was like a little kid.
Wow.
And yeah, Johnny Mae, Aunt Johnny Mae, yeah.
Did you meet her?
Yes. She was around all the time, like family get-togethers and stuff. Actually, my sister Holly, God bless Holly. When I have this memory, and I've told this story so many times that it's actually, I don't even know if it's real anymore, but when Holly was like 12 or something, I remember being at some family thing and Johnny Mae was like, said to Holly, oh, you're looking real strong. Like, we're going to make a wrestler out of you. Like sort of joking around. And Holly was like mortified because she was like a 12-year-old girl. And she didn't want to look strong.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to be pretty and like, you know. but yeah, and then Johnny Mae was like, didn't understand. Like, why would you, like, that's a good thing. Like, I don't get it. But yeah, no, Johnny Mae, we didn't see her all the time. I mean, she was busy being a professional wrestler and whatever. But yeah, she would come, you know, there's a whole deep ass fucking history there. And
oh yeah.
You know, I don't think that, I mean, she ran away from home and, but yeah, there's some reconciliation later in all the lives of the Youngs, and the disputes sort of mellowed out and the sibling spats and the dark things mellowed out, you know. We all live long enough for shit to mellow out, you know.
Have you written about this? I feel like this is a thing people would want to read.
I've like tried to write about it sort of at an angle. I was working for several years on a novel in a sort of like Cormac McCarthy-ish sort of vibe or tone about a professional wrestler who was basically Mae Young in this sort of strange, surreal world that was sort of like tracing, you know, I was another cis white man trying to understand 20th century American history through popular culture. But yeah, my friend Gene Kwok, who's a wonderful fiction writer who everyone should go read, he really wants me to finish the Lady Wrestling novel, and he'll text me about it sometimes. He'll be like, man, you remember that wrestling novel? Like, you should finish that. He wrote a great wrestling novel called Go Home, Ricky. But I don't know. Maybe I'll come back to it.
Or you
it,
could write a song about her, like the ballad of your aunt.
Maybe. I've never thought about doing that. Yeah. I'm sort of at a crossroads with what to write songs about right now. So,
well, yeah, I saw a Tumblr where you had like 60 songs you put up. I was like,
yeah, that was like fucking 15 years ago, maybe longer. Let's see, 2025, 2011. No, wait, no, 2013. 12 years? 12 years.
Yeah.
Something like that. No, I got a lot of songs, so maybe I've written enough.
You go back and get, you go back to your Tumblr with the 60 songs, get one of those and redo it.
I've in fact done that.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I need to write anything else. I mean, maybe I just wrote enough. Maybe I'm done.
So the tour you're going on, are these songs you've written?
Yes. Yes. Okay. All the Clementine songs are songs that I've written with Gion. And every now and then somebody else will throw something in. Shout out to LK James, who is a great illustrator, who is married and has children with the wonderful poet Mark Leidner. So a little bit of trivia for the trivia heads out there. We have a song called River Boys, and the chorus goes, sleep, sleep, sleep in the river boys. And then LK wrote the line, rest in the mossy green bed. So back in the Nashville days, when you wrote a song in Nashville, it would be like, change a word, get a third of royalties. So if River Boys, if I ever fucking sold River Boys to Toyota or something, I would need to give some money to LK. So don't let me off the hook, LK. Get your royalty money from me.
So you know how
it blows up.
So you know how there's like the Blues Brothers? Would you ever buy like Clementine colored suits with Gion and like wear those?
I mean,
and,
if
like...
I made a shit ton of money, but I have a feeling being a 38-year-old man in a band with white hair and my beard that I have had to kicking and screamingly reorient my very millennial perspective on success and art, and have had to come to a much healthier understanding of exactly how much Clementine Was Right is going to quote unquote blow up. So no, I do not think Clementine Was Right is ever going to blow up to the point that we will buy orange suits. but maybe with the last show, maybe if I decide to end the band in a very dramatic way, which sort of seems like something I would do, maybe the me in 10 years, I don't even fucking know that guy. Maybe he'll be really into endings and he'll buy orange suits for everybody and have a real sort of fucking, you know, Clementine sunset kind of funeral.
Oh, that's cool.
But who knows? Who knows what Mike, 48-year-old Mike will do? Hopefully he'll sleep better. He'll snore less. He'll have lower blood pressure, lower cholesterol.
So you're saying that you've reconciled with not blowing up?
Yeah. I think that the healthiest way, there's a Mojave 3 song called My Life in Art. That's a great song. And I think the healthiest way to have a life in art, what I would love is to be able to putter around in my van for about maybe a third of the year. I think a third, and go to like everywhere and have about 20 people in a living room who are like really happy to see me and the band, if there's a band, you know, and maybe even the band's different people, you know, in and out. Maybe like James Brown used to have a different band in every city. Maybe it's like that. And 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, no, people in a living room. And we just catch up. And I play some of my songs. I mean, I am only there for one night. So maybe I play for about 30 to 40 minutes. And then, you know, somebody I know plays for about 20 to 30 minutes. Somebody I don't know, but everybody's like, oh, you got to meet so-and-so, plays for about 20 to 30 minutes. And we all just hang out and there's a big potluck. There's this movie called Underground. I always mess it up. It's not Underworld. It's Underground by Costa Rica. And the end of that movie is, it's all about the Balkans. And the end of that movie is there's this little island that is broken off and it's floating away. And it's very small. It's just small enough to have a sort of boisterous dinner table with about 20 people at it. And there people are eating and laughing and yelling at each other and fighting and kissing and throwing things. And it's just a tiny little island and it's just floating off into eternity. And it's just, it's life right there. You know, it's the kitchen table. And if I could just do that until I like keel over like fucking Dale Earnhardt somewhere, or, you know, on my 80s and, you know, Gion is there with me. And that would be pretty cool. And that doesn't involve, I don't know how many monthly listeners I would need on Spotify to achieve this vision.
It sounds like the life kind of a parallel of like an indie wrestler.
Like driving around. What do you mean by that?
Like driving around to small towns, I guess. Or like maybe the old school days when there wasn't like the WWF. Just like driving around to small territories, like with other wrestlers and just enjoying. I don't know if they're enjoying themselves, but like performing in front of people. And then they'd also stay at like people's houses just to get by. They didn't have very much money.
I love it. I love it. Yeah. Now I romanticize. I mean, there's good.
You got to be happy or like have an optimistic look on it or else you get like depressed.
Yeah. But I also love my friends.
Yeah.
You know, and like having lived many different places and being 38 years old.
You're still young.
Thank you. I've been fishing for that the entire time. Every time I've said the words 38, I've been like, well, Tyler did not reassure me. I was young, so I guess I have to say it again.
Yeah.
You know, like, I like living in a place. I mean, I don't have total wanderlust, but I want to see everybody. You know, I want to see everybody. I will say the other thing is that has only gotten more poignant. You know, it's like, I don't know if being a poet or an artist, you end up with statistically higher fucking percentage of your friends dying, but, I don't know, but, or if it hits you harder, I think it's arrogant to think that it actually hits artists harder or whatever. They just like stew in it maybe, but yeah, I fucking hate it when my friends die and I would love to see all of them as in this greedy, greedy way. Like, actually Dara blurbed my first book of poems, right? It's called We Are All Good If They Try Hard Enough, and Adam Robinson put it out. Thank you, Adam. And Dara said something in the blurb about how the poems and me by extension am as like greedy as Proust. And I didn't know what the fuck she was talking about. But as I get older and my friends die, I like understand. I'm like, oh man, Dara was like cooking on that one. She knew. She fucking knew what she was talking about. I just want to see all my friends. Yeah.
So I know you're like, I used to associate you with Lucy K. Shaw and the Shabby Doll House people.
Yeah.
Within their activities. How'd you meet them? And how did you come up with the name for like Oscar's book, or what's the story behind that?
For what?
For Oscar's book, didn't you come up with the name? For like emo.
Oh, I came up with an. Oh, I did come up with teen surf goth, didn't I? I don't remember how I came up with that. I did come up with that. I mean, just Chris Oscar's vibe is teen surf goth.
It is.
It's sort of like teen surf goth, you know? It's like my friend Rachel Glazer, who's an incredible writer. We had this other friend, also a great poet with a mustache, Ari Feld. And Rachel named his book in grad school. And Rachel was like, you know what, Ari? You know what you are? Ancient cool. And he was like, okay, my book is called Ancient Cool now. How did I meet them? How did I meet them? Online, I think, but also in New York when I was living in Western Mass. Matt Nelson and Jacob. We got to edit this so Jacob does not hear me. Perkins. Oh my God.
You name like 500 people and then like one.
But it's Jacob. Like, I have to remember Jacob's name. Great painter. Wonderful guy. They started this thing called Mellow Pages that was very beautiful and temporary, as most beautiful things are. And I really hung out with Lucy and Chris and Gabby Bess and all those great, great people. And this was like a cool another little era and another little scene. And it was like 2013. It was after, I'd like gone through sort of a sad breakup with a also wonderful writer named Carolyn Zykowski in Western Massachusetts. And I was sort of looking for a new scene because being in Western Mass was sad. And so I was like getting on the Peter Pan bus all the time to New York and hanging out at Mellow Pages. And it was a beautiful time. I would sleep on the couch at Mellow Pages and Bed-Stuy and the light would come through the big fucking warehouse windows. And
that's crazy that you like found this other huge other scene that like ends up becoming a thing.
I seek to do that a lot in my life. And I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I seem to just like want to be. Yeah, I don't know. It's the Costa Rica living room desire, you know?
So why do you think you're so great friends with them?
I love Lucy, man. I don't know, like, Lucy has, I think, in her kind of making chapbooks, cultivating a community, putting people's books out. I might be projecting. She sang also on like Meet Me in the Dark. She beautifully sang on Meet Me in the Dark with Lisa Corey. I think Lucy shares maybe with me, you have to ask Lucy this if it's true, but it's related to this parlor trick of saying everybody's name. It's not because I'm name dropping or I want people to think I'm cool. It's because like I knew so few people growing up.
Yeah, I feel the same.
And I feel so tenderly and so covetous of my friends and people I think are cool. Mm-hmm. And I just feel so acutely that it could all go away at any time.
Yeah.
And I want to celebrate them while they're here. And I don't know if Lucy feels the same, but that's the energy I get in her work with Shabby Dollhouse. So maybe that's why we like each other. Who knows?
I feel the same way because there's this like shaming for like the name dropping or like that's like an insult or something. I'm like, why is that a bad thing? I just want to say people's names that I know. Because like
it's all contextual, you know. If you say it because you're insecure, or if one's not you, but if one says it because one is insecure, and one has like a, you know, a fucking like void where, you know, a piece of bread should be inside themselves, then maybe like you want to fill yourself up with other people so people think that you exist or something, but. I don't think I do it like that. Like I'm pretty aware that I exist, unfortunately. And like, I just want people to forget. I don't want people to forget people. I don't want people to be forgotten. We're all going to get forgotten. Ozymandias, right? Like we're all going to fucking wash away. There's fucking Lucy K. Shaw and fucking year 1088 out there who was making chapbooks and in like, you know, like Isleta Pueblo in what is now called, quote unquote, New Mexico, you know, down with the American Empire. And they were doing poems and laughing and hanging out with their friends and being brilliant. And we don't fucking know who that person is, right? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's very strange to me. That's very like, whoa. So yeah, let's say a few names while we're here, you know?
But she like also brings you back for other activities. Like, weren't you on her recent podcast?
Yeah. I was on that very cool, this was like maybe a year or two ago now, but like when Chris's book came out. Oh, I love doing stuff with them, and yeah, they're always doing such cool stuff. We were trying to get over there to Europe and like visit them, because we finally, Gian and I have a little bit of money now, but all this fucking Trump stuff and like fucking, you know, just people trying to fucking slow roll the genocide of trans people. It's very dark. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, it's like, we're afraid that if we leave the country, we won't be able to come back. And that's awful. You know, it's like, we have to fucking do something about this. We have to like, we have to start with the people in your immediate vicinity and like protect people who are vulnerable right now, because it's just, things are not good right now. You know, so hopefully things won't be this way forever, and we'll get to go hang out and gallop around the quote unquote continent with Lucy and Chris, because we love them. But yeah, until then, waving at each other through the pixels.
Did she go to you? Because she has I was in her chapbook class, but you ran like a chapbook business for a while.
Oh, you mean Magic Helicopter Press? Yes, yeah. Yes, I publish things. And
how'd you start that? How'd you come up with that?
Oh, I came up with that just same deal, you know, just being enthusiastic. Mary Miller was the first chapbook. I was like, this person's stories are so good, somebody should put them out. Well, nobody's doing it, maybe I'll do it. And then Daniel Bailey with the Drunk Sonnets was the first Perfect Bound book that we put out. We had a blog, me and Dan, and Kendra Grant Malone and Tao Lin, and we all had this blog called the Drunk Blog, where we would post like drunk poems. I never got that drunk, so I was sort of an imposter. But one day, Dan just dropped like 60 incredible poems on the fucking Drunk Blog. It was like a private blog that was just an in-joke for us, right?
That's cool.
And I was like, man, these poems are so fucking good. And Brian, I can't forget about Brian. Brian Kofelt, my dear friend from undergrad, Ashland, was also on the Drunk Blog. But yeah, Dan dropped 60 poems on there one day, and I was like, well, gotta make a book. And I learned how to make a book. And I don't really do that anymore, because I do the music stuff now and, you know, seasons of life and all that. But I am working on putting out my friend with a group of people, working on putting out posthumously my friend Elliot Harmon's book. It won't be like a Magic Helicopter thing, or maybe it will, I don't know. Because I sort of like have some other people's books that I actually still owe putting them out. And so I got to finish those before I can call anything else a Magic Helicopter book. But yeah, working on putting Elliot's book out, and it feels pretty cool. Sort of dipping my toe back in it. A lot of like weird, maybe trauma around the writing world and stuff.
What happened? So,
I don't know.
Oh.
Not interesting.
Okay. I won't go into it.
But like, it's been nice to celebrate Elliot. I think to zoom out, to answer your question, I've become more and more restless as I've gotten older, that you can't just do one thing. You can't just be a writer. You can't just be a musician. I don't know what you're supposed to be instead. It's just a feeling I have. And I don't know what the answer is. Yeah.
Well, I think like being a creative, you find the creative process, and then you want to experiment and go do other things and get that feeling back of putting something out, being scared, being terrified, and then putting it out and going through the process. I mean, like the old writers, like Baraka, he was like involved with 50 different things all at once, you know?
Yeah, I think that's healthy. I think that's healthy. I agree with you. I agree with you. That's probably a big part of it. Speaking of healthy, I'm like running out of saliva and breath. Mm-hmm. So I feel pretty good. I feel like you're doing a great job. And okay. So maybe we can like, what do you say we like get to the, do you have like quest, like the last big question you want to ask?
What would you like to, reflecting back on your life, is there any advice that you have for writers out there?
Now I really get to be 38.
I'm 36, man, so listen.
I'm like frightening you. I love, you should leave that silence in there, because yeah. That silence was like me waiting for you to like tell me that I'm young again, you know, and then you didn't. You were just, we just became scared of getting old together. Advice is a hard one. You know, it's funny because like I have my friends these days are like in their 20s, and it's very strange to me because I'm like, yeah, I'm watching you do this. I can tell you what to do, but you're not going to like listen to me. You're going to fucking touch the stove. And it's so, you know, and I'm not exactly sure what to do or what to say, because I wouldn't have listened if somebody had told me exactly what to do, even if they were right.
Do you tell Gion what to do? And then maybe...
Nah, Gion tells me what to do. Advice. I think that at this moment, it's just more important than ever to really take care of your friends and the people close to you, and meet your neighbors, talk to people who are younger than you, talk to people who are older than you, cook dinner, learn how to cook. I think all of these things will make your songs and your poems better. Read everything you can, listen to everything you can, go fucking look shit up. If Barry Hanna like blurbs the back of the Dennis Johnson book, if Grace Paley blurbs the back of the Joy Williams book, I don't know if Grace Paley ever blurbed Joy Williams, but go look those people up, go trace the constellations, and do it, you know, like while you're talk, you know, with your friends about books and songs, while you're making dinner for them, with them, have house parties, like lie to the cops, lie to the government, strategically riot, you know. I think those are all my advice. Those are all my pieces of advice about writing better poems. Yeah.
When's your next book coming out?
How fuck if I know? I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't have a book in the hopper right now. But I'm feeling a little booky energy these days. This might just be the pandery part of me. You know, I talk to like a book dude, a literary dude like yourself, and I'm like, I'm gonna pretend that I'm a writer again, you know. But
is it a good feeling though? Is it good to feel that way for a little moment?
Oh yeah. No, it's good. It's good. I mean, because like the nice thing about singing is that it does, and playing music and whatnot, is that like I think I dwell on the 38-year-old thing because like it's not like you can't keep doing it, you know, like look at Michael Hurley or fucking Dan Reeder or fucking look at Camilla Dawson, you know, great musician. But it's just physically harder to play music, whereas it's like you can write until you're fucking blinking your last syllables, you know, like Oliver Sacks or whatever, like on your deathbed. So I'm sort of think that like writing is going to be there for me when I'm living in my little cabin in the Redwoods, or like when Gion and I are like posted up in an undisclosed location in northern New Mexico, you know. and writing will be there for me. And then I can be like, there's this Australian singer-songwriter named Darren Hanlon who has this little break in one of his songs where he goes, it's like he's been sort of, the song has been sort of like trotting along, and there's this list and there's this list, and then he goes like, and all the things I learned, or something is the melody, and then he's like, what did I learn? You know, and so I just love that moment. I feel like at some point in my life, maybe I will have like a, I'll sit back down and I'll be like, what did I learn? And then I'll write it all down or something. But until then, I'll play some songs in some living rooms in Memphis, Nashville, Asheville, Charlotte, Durham, Athens, Atlanta, Jackson, Mississippi, New Orleans, Little Rock, and Fayetteville in April 2025.
Are you ever going to come to Tulsa?
And Jude Brothers. We played a great show in Tulsa in 2023.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, at this cool bar that I'm blanking on the name of, but there was lightning outside. Yeah, I'd love to come back to Tulsa. I just got to be strategic about it, you know?
How much does, if I went out and tried to book you somewhere, invited you down, would that cost me something? How much, like, what's the money here?
Oh, man. I mean, I was just joking about this because I'm working on some events and stuff with some more official people who are having a bit of a like, how much could a banana cost, you know, like how much does a band cost, like $1,000? I'm like, well, if it's my friend's band, it's like $2,000, you know.
Wow.
But then the reality is that we would be happy if we made like $100 at a show, but you can't let the people in charge know that, you know. I don't know, like, it'd be sick as hell if you got us a show in Tulsa with a guarantee. But that's not usually how it works. But like I said, going back to the living room thing, the coolest thing would be, because there are bars that feel like living rooms. So if the bar feels like that, that's great. And I think the bar that we played in Tulsa did sort of feel like that. I don't remember the name of it. Zach Arnett was there. Maybe he books at that bar, or he was playing. He's like a cool musician dude in Tulsa. I gotta remember the name of this bar. Wait, is it Zach Arnett, not Arnett. Hmm. Arnett, cool Tulsa musician. So you and Zach Arnett get together, and we'll get Clementine just right back to Tulsa.
So I just like call up the bar and I ask for a date, and then do I have to pay them?
No, you don't have to pay them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, they will do like a ticketed show. Or like, if they're a cool bar, they'll give you like a cut of the drinks that night. That's like the real sort of cool way to do it. But there's a million different ways to do it. This is a separate series of 82-hour long podcasts about the fucking music industry in 2025. But yeah, we'll come back to Tulsa. You don't have to call the bar. We'll figure it out. We'll come back to Tulsa. Just come to the show and bring all your friends. That's cool. That's the coolest thing to do, is come to the show and bring like five friends or something, four friends.
Maybe we'll get Orchid up here.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, maybe. I would love that. I would love to hang out with Orchid again. And I do think that we all have to be a little better and a little more conscientious about the fact that, you know, the pandemic isn't over, and like disabled people are feeling really isolated right now. Everybody's feeling isolated. And there's a lot of, you know, like, things are bad, and it's very, I don't know the answer, but I would love to hang out with Orchid again, and love to be at, you know, just sing at the top of our lungs. You know, just wear some masks. Orchid actually, we played a house show in Austin. It was outdoors, and so it was like healthy and good, and Orchid came, and it was very beautiful. We did that last March. Oh, and wow. It was a beautiful little house, and a bunch of friends came out, and yeah, so I have a feeling that we'll all meet again.
Spaceballs
too. August for more money. Yeah, he was there at that show. Yeah.
Nice.
Great guy. Great weird poet, musician.
You gotta go on his podcast.
Cool. I think Gion did. I'll have to ask him. I think Gion went on his podcast. I can't remember. I'm pretty sure Gion went on his podcast.
I had Gion on mine.
Yes, I know Gian went on your podcast. I'm pretty sure Gian was on August's podcast as well. But yeah, August was at that show, and I love August. Yeah, cool dude. Yeah, we want to get August out here to Denver. Yeah. I think Gian was talking to August about it, but we want to get all our friends out to the island where we eat Thanksgiving together.
See, I'm having August come down here for reading like the first of the month of August or late July. So it'd be cool if I had you guys also up here.
Okay. I'll do it. Late July. Give me a date.
First weekend of August. Yeah.
Okay. First weekend of August.
We'll see. I still have to like call at bars. So I've never done that before. So
I can help you if you want. Yeah, we could have a fun little show, maybe a house show, maybe a bar. We'll figure it out.
Cool.
I'm biased toward the house show. If you get a nice backyard, we'll figure it out. But I think it'd be fun. It'd be very sweet. Okay. Cool. We'll get the poets. I love it when the poets and the country musicians meet. It's always hilarious and very exciting. And they they're like looking at each other like toucans and lions in the wild and sort of sniffing around. And then they're by the end of the night, everybody's drunk and laughing and happy. We got these great neighbors, all different ages, and we just invite them over. We have this friend who was asking us, because we do house shows and whatnot, and he was like, how do you do it? How do you do a house show? And I was like, I don't know, man. I mean, I guess the first step is like invite your neighbors. He like gets out his little notebook and he's like, oh, talk to my neighbors. Wow. Yeah. And I was like, first step, man. That's the first step. But yeah, we got a bunch of neighbors and they just seem so happy to be like invited over and with the fucking queer blue-haired weirdos dancing in the living room. And there are like, you know, we're in Denver and we're in a pretty nice neighborhood. So it's like sort of, you know, I would say middle to upper middle class, like.
But are you afraid of them being like Trump and like being ultra conservative?
We're lucky. We have one neighbor who seems perhaps like he is a Trumper. And it's probably not safe to invite him over to our parties in this day and age. Some part of me, this maybe goes back to the video game thing, but it's like, I can win him over.
Yeah.
I can make him like be like into all our friends and like into trans rights and like into punk music. But Gian is like, I don't know, that doesn't seem very safe. And I'm like, you're probably right. Life is not a video game. We have to be smart and be safe, but I have like a sort of stupid little sentimentality inside my heart that I'm like, and maybe it's sort of macho too. Maybe it's a little macho. I'm like, I can convince anyone to be cool.
I think it's also, you know? Like if you're trans or queer, you're like super selective on who you're going to let in. Cause you have to be,
You have to be safe, you know? And we have these great friends in Athens, Georgia, who are in this band called Newport Transplant. And I love them so much. And I think that they're just really tough, genius, brilliant. They're in a harder place and they're just fucking, they just keep each other safe. You know, they keep each other safe and they like keep each other happy and they're mad. You know, people are mad at each other sometimes, but everybody is, you know, it's the Costa Rica, it's the dinner table, it's the floating island, man. And some people you don't want fucking anybody to shoot you on your fucking dinner table island. That would fucking suck. So you gotta be smart, but yeah, I would love to die with a omelet.
Why do you keep talking about dying? You're not gonna die anytime soon.
Everybody's gonna die sometime.
You're pretty peaceful with it. You keep talking about it. Don't manifest it.
I won't manifest it, but I'm very acutely aware that you never know. Once you have a parent who dies and then you have friends die in very traumatic ways, you are surfing another wave for real. For real.
But you see Gion and they're like living their life to the fullest.
Gian is very inspiring to me. He does live his life to the fullest, and Yeah, I try to keep up with him. Yeah, Guion crowd surfed the other night. This is a good place to end the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
All the listeners out there who have listened now to an hour and a half of this podcast, I want you to picture the world's greatest poet, Guion Davis, grew up on a sheep farm in Española. I want you to picture Guion Davis at a sort of smoky music hall in Denver, Colorado, with green smoke as great local Denver band Horse Bitch plays to a sold out room of about 300 people and plays just great songs, playing this song called a Pirate Ride, which is about going to Disneyland after your friend. So I'm back to death, going to Disneyland after your friend's mom dies. And it's a joyous room there, just 300 people moshing to the sort of Irishy kind of like pedal steel fiddle, and Guion Davis in his cowboy boots and cowboy shirt. I'm standing, we're both sort of standing sort of stage right, sort of near the wall, you know, because I'm really convinced that I'm old and I'm not allowed to be in the pit anymore. And, you know, I've got a mask on because I don't want to get sick. And Guion has a mask on. And Guion is like, fuck it. And Guion like hands me his Horse Bitch hat and his leather jacket and strides up to the barricade in front of the stage and just leaps into the stage, leaps off the barricade into the crowd and is crowd surfing with his cowboy boots on. And there's a great video of it where he's just smiling. And from the stage, Riley Marino says, Riley Marino, many people have been crowd surfing. And Riley Marino, guitar player for Horse Bitch, has not commented on anyone else crowd surfing yet, but comments from the stage, if you guys let Guion die, I'm never going to forgive you. And Guion is just smiling very big and crowd surfing in his cowboy boots. And so that's the image I would like to leave this episode of the podcast with.